We are continuing our study today in what we might call the future of the kingdom. But in this extended study of God's dream for the world, we see that when Jesus comes to talk about what that dream looks like, he talks about kingdom. And his 3 years of ministry are focused around that theme. And we've looked at parts of that along the way. And now, since Easter, we're thinking about the future, because the perspective of the New Testament is that the kingdom has come, but it will come. That is, there's already a reality that is in the world that you and I can experience of God's and Jesus' lordship, his work to bring about his ultimate purposes for the world. That's already here. But it's not here in its fullness. So that's why the scholars say the kingdom has come and the kingdom will come. And we're thinking more about that future side now. The kingdom will come. What does that look like, and what does Jesus have to say to us and to his disciples about that? So last week, we started looking at a passage that is really complicated, Matthew 24 and 25. And we said we're jumping into the deep end of the pool, but last week we jumped in with our floaties on. So that doesn't really count. This week we got to take our floaties off, and a bit different story, right? So I want to go back and actually look at, once again, the text we looked at last week, because we left out some verses. Some astute people wrote me questions saying, why did you leave out those verses? Well, it's because we still had our floaties on. And today we need to go back and take a look at those verses and see if we can make sense out of these, the first part of this discussion. You remember, perhaps last week, I suggested to you that the discussion that Jesus has from the beginning of this chapter through verse 35 relates to the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70. Now, that's part of what we need to look at again today. And I would say this, that while there are many, many complexities in these passages and lots of disagreement among the Bible scholars, we shouldn't allow that to fog over the things that are very clear. And there's a lot that's very clear. The really important stuff is very clear. It's clear that Jesus knows the future. He knows the future because he is Lord of Lords and King of Kings, and he is the one who directs the future. Right? So that's a major point in what he's teaching the disciples. We might be tempted to say, well, yes, of course. But that's really a huge thing, see, that we learn to live with this confidence that the future belongs to our God. And so we are in his care. We rest in that. Jesus knows the future. It is his future. And Jesus is coming back. He will fulfill his promises, and the kingdom will come in its fullness and completeness. That's very, very clear. So let's keep those things in mind as we, at the same time, admit that there's complexities here in how we understand it. All right, that said, let me read these verses once again. Jesus left the temple and was walking away when his disciples came up to him to call his attention to its buildings. Do you see all these things? He asked. Truly, I tell you, not one stone here will be left on another. Every one will be thrown down. As Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately. Tell us, they said, when will this happen? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? Jesus answered, watch out that no one deceives you. For many will come in my name, claiming, I am the Messiah, and will deceive many. You will hear of wars and rumors of wars, but see to it that you are not alarmed. Such things must happen, but the end is still to come. Nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of birth pangs. Then you will be handed over to be persecuted and put to death, and you will be hated by all nations because of me. At that time, many will turn away from the faith and will betray and hate each other, and many false prophets will appear and deceive many people. Because of the increase of wickedness, the love of most will grow cold, but the one who stands firm to the end will be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. So, when you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation spoken of through the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let no one on the housetop go down to take anything out of the house. Let no one in the field go back to get their cloak. How dreadful it will be in those days for pregnant women and nursing mothers. Pray that your flight will not take place in winter or on the Sabbath. For then there will be great distress, unequaled from the beginning of the world until now, and never to be equaled again. If those days had not been cut short, no one would survive. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be shortened. At that time, if anyone says to you, "Look, here's the Messiah," or "There he is," do not believe it. For false messiahs and false prophets will appear and perform great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. See, I have told you ahead of time. So if anyone tells you, "There he is, out in the wilderness," do not go out. Or, "Here he is, in the inner rooms," do not believe it. For as lightning that comes from the east is visible even to the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Wherever there is a carcass, there the vultures will gather. And then the verses that we didn't read last week. Immediately after the distress of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from the sky, and the heavenly bodies will be shaken. Then will appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. And then all the peoples of the earth will mourn when they see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of the heavens to the other. Now learn this lesson from the fig tree. As soon as its twigs get tender and its leaves come out, you know that summer is near. Even so, when you see all these things, you know that it is near, right at the door. Truly I tell you, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will never pass away. All right, so here's the problem in the way that I've been framing this out. Verse 34 says, all these things are going to happen within this generation. Right? But the verses that we read today that we didn't read last week say, the sun's going to be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars are going to fall from heaven, and then you will see the sign of the Son of Man in heaven coming on the clouds with power and great glory. You say, well, that didn't happen, did it? So, how can this all take place by AD 70? That sounds like the end of the age. You feeling the problem? Wish you had your floaties back on? All right, so this then leads the biblical scholars into all directions. The liberal biblical scholars say, well, Jesus was very astute. He could see what was going to happen politically to Jerusalem, but he also thought that he was going to return by that time and these other cosmic signs were going to happen, and he was wrong. Now, I don't find that an acceptable view. So what then are the alternatives? One alternative is to say, you know, there are more immediate things that he talks about, and there are then distant future things, and they are woven together in a difficult way. And it's hard to extract them. Probably the majority of scholars go that direction. Then there are some scholars who say, well, the problem is that all of these things are future. The abomination of desolation is still future. And the cosmic signs are still future. And the blooming of the fig tree that he talks about, that's still future. And what he's saying is that when that starts, you got one generation and everything's going to be finished. But all of it's future. And then there's the view I'm suggesting that up through verse 35, all these events relate to the fall of Jerusalem and in a sense to the first coming of Jesus, and everything after verse 35, we'll look at that next week, relates to a yet future reality, okay? So I've got a problem. If I say this was fulfilled in the first generation that Jesus was talking to, what do we do with the coming of the Son of Man and the cosmic signs, right? So you with me this far? You don't have to agree with me, but if you understand how I'm processing this. So let's remind ourselves of the signpost Jesus gives. The signpost comes out of the book of Daniel. He says, when you see the abomination spoken of by Daniel the prophet, get out of town. There are four passages in Daniel that seem to refer to something, you know, that use this kind of language of desecration, desolation, abomination. And I'm just quoting one of them here from Daniel chapter 11. It talks about a king from the north who will invade the promised land. It says his armed forces will rise up to desecrate the temple, fortress, will abolish the daily sacrifice, then they will set up the abomination that causes desolation. And so here's the temple. The temple is going to be desecrated. The implication is that Jerusalem is going to get stomped. And in fact, the fulfillment of this seems to have taken place 200 years before Jesus, when the Syrian king from the north, invaded the Holy Land and suppressed Judea, attacked Jerusalem, was able to gain access, and part of it was the desecration of the temple, the stopping of the daily sacrifice, persecuting Jews who circumcised their young boys. That was the covenant sign that God gave to Abraham. Antiochus said none of that stuff. And then they sacrificed a pig on the altar. That seems to be the abomination that creates desolation. That's 200 years before Jesus. Now notice what he does. He says, when you see the abomination. They saw it 200 years before. But he's taking up that idea and he's saying there's going to be a repeat performance, unfortunately. When you see that, if you understand Daniel, you'll know what's happening. And when you do see it, get out of town. The disciples who preserved those words of Jesus and taught them to his disciples, they understood 40 years later, less than 40 years later, when Roman armies surrounded Jerusalem in that rebellion that the Jews started in AD 66 and was pretty much done by AD 70. When they saw those armies, the Christians remembered the words of Jesus and they left Jerusalem. They went to neighboring Pella, and the majority of the Christians were spared because of Jesus' words. So, we've got an abomination in 167 BC. 200 years later, Jesus says, when you see that, and when you see it is going to be within this generation. This generation will not pass away until all these things are fulfilled. The early Christians saw that. They listened to the teaching of Jesus. They got out of town. And I suggested that everything prior to verse 34 is in this time period, right? Well, so the question that was posed last week, what about a couple of these difficult things? Can we imagine that they occurred? What about the shaking of the heavens? Jesus says in verse 29, immediately after the distress of those days, he's tying it right together with the destruction of Jerusalem, right? Immediately after the distress of those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from the skies, and the heavenly bodies will be shaken. All right. Well, that's a problem. That didn't happen, did it? And then what about verse 30 where he says, you will see the sign of the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. Did that happen? Or is that still future? Well, let's think about each of these. The cosmic signs, sun darkened, moon not giving its light, stars falling from heaven. What kind of language is this? If you have a New International Version, you will notice that they set it in poetic type, right? They're trying to say something of the translator's understanding of this. And what they're suggesting and what probably a majority of scholars agree on, is that Jesus is here alluding to some passages in the Old Testament. He's already done that in referencing Daniel, right? And so the thought is here, once again, he's using Old Testament language to talk about what's going to happen. Specifically, he's referring to some passages of prophecy, which, however, are poetry. You know, large sections of the prophets are actually Hebrew poetry. And that's what Jesus seems to be referring to here. So let's think about a couple of these cases. For example, Ezekiel, in exile in Babylon, prophesies that Babylon is going to crush Egypt. And speaking with a divine voice, here's what Ezekiel says. When I snuff you out, he's talking to Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. When I snuff you out, I will cover the heavens and darken their stars. I will cover the sun with a cloud, and the moon will not give its light. Sound a little bit familiar? This is judgment against Egypt, which already happened. Babylon did go down and invade Egypt and humiliated the Egyptians. It's already happened. Isaiah prophesies a similar kind of judgment against Babylon. And this is actually one of the passages that the scholars think Jesus is referencing. We know that the scroll of Isaiah was very important to him. Here's what Isaiah says. Behold, the day of the Lord. Day of the Lord is a reference to a time of judgment. The day of the Lord comes, cruel, both with wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate, verse 10, for the stars of heaven and the constellations thereof shall not give their light, the sun shall be darkened in its going forth. That's God's judgment on Babylon. That also has happened. Another passage from Isaiah. This is a judgment that falls on Edom, one of Israel's nearby enemies. All the hosts of heaven shall be dissolved, and the heavens shall be rolled together as a scroll, and all their hosts shall fall down. So what do we have here? What we have is a poetic way of talking about shattering judgments. You know, a parallel to the way we might talk is we might talk about earth-shattering events, right? Serious stuff. Earth-shattering events, we don't literally think of the earth breaking up, but we have an image there, a metaphor that helps us. And so I think these cosmic signs function that way. They don't happen literally, but they really happen. And what I'd suggest to you is that Jesus actually picks up this language, particularly from Isaiah. And now, as he does with Daniel, the abomination has already taken place. Jesus says it's going to happen again, repeat performance. So he takes the language of Isaiah and he says, this has happened. It's going to happen again. And this generation is going to see it. This generation is going to see the judgment of God poured out on its sinfulness. Jerusalem is going to be crushed. Remember how the discourse starts. The disciples say, look at these glorious buildings. Jesus says, not one stone is going to be left on another. Well, you say, that might work for the cosmic signs, but how about where Jesus says he's coming on the clouds of heaven? You will see the sign of the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven. Surely that didn't take place. Well, let's think about that. Where does that language come from? You're right. Glad you thought about it. It comes from the Old Testament again. Specifically, it comes from Daniel chapter 7, which is a critical passage because it's in Daniel chapter 7 that we find this appearance of the term Son of Man, which Jesus then used as the primary way to describe who he was. He only occasionally accepts the title Messiah. His preferred title is Son of Man, and he takes it out of Daniel chapter 7. Now let's listen to this vision that Daniel has. In my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man coming with the clouds of heaven. There's the language of Jesus. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshiped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away. And his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. So Jesus takes this language, and he says, you're going to see the sign of the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. He's pointing to this vision. And here is an interesting thing to note. In the vision, the Son of Man doesn't come to earth. He comes to God's presence. See that? Comes on the clouds of heaven, but he comes before the Ancient of Days, which is the way that Daniel talks about God. This coming is not the same as his return at the end of the age. This is a coming into God's presence. And if you go back and read Daniel, what is happening here is that it is a scene of vindication. It's a scene of judgment in which God pronounces in favor of the Son of Man. Now, or another way to say it is, Daniel 7, 13 and 14 is an enthronement scene. Because the Son of Man comes on the clouds into the presence of God, and he is given a kingdom, and he's given power and authority and glory that will never pass away. It's an enthronement. Now, I'm going to suggest to you that when Jesus is talking to his disciples about the events surrounding AD 70 and the fall of Jerusalem, that he is applying there the Daniel passage, because in effect he is saying, when you see Jerusalem destroyed, you will know that my word is true, that I am who I claim to be, and you will see the outworking of Daniel chapter 7. The Son of Man, which is, he's talking about himself, right? And people know that that's how he's referring to himself. He's saying the Son of Man is going to be vindicated before God. Now, he wasn't vindicated before his enemies. See, these words are given, what, a day, 2 days, maybe 3 days before his crucifixion? Not long. It's that Holy Week, the Passion Week. And in a few days from when he announces this, the Jewish leaders and the Roman overlords are going to have two trials. And in both trials, they are going to judge that he is a fraud, that he's not who he claims to be. The human courts will sit, they will render a judgment, and they will kill him. Jesus says, my friends, within one generation, anyone who wants to see will understand that I, the Son of Man, have been vindicated by God himself. The divine court will reverse the judgment of the human courts. And you will see that. And so, just a couple days later, at his trial, what does he do? He references these same verses. Do you remember this? The high priest says to him, "Tell us clearly, are you the Messiah?" And as typical of Jesus, he doesn't answer that head on. He says, "You've said so. But I say to all of you, from now on, you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." Same verse, huh? From now on, which I take it means, from now on, from the time you put me to death, and in 3 days, you realize you have a big problem on your hands. You have an empty tomb that you can't explain. And the empty tomb and the resurrection of Jesus is the first sign to the world that the Son of Man has been vindicated, that he's come on the clouds of heaven into his Father's presence, and he has received a kingdom and glory and power that will never pass away. And so it's only a short time later that he, Matthew 28, he appears to his disciples. And what does he say? "All authority has been given unto me in heaven and on earth. Therefore, you go and make disciples of all the nations. The Son of Man has been vindicated by the Ancient of Days. All right, so that was a quick spin through some of those difficult passages. So I'm still going to suggest to you, lots of people disagree with me, but I'm still going to suggest that one of the best ways to make sense of this whole discourse is to see that from the beginning of chapter 24 through verse 35, we're talking about the events surrounding the fall of Jerusalem. Then next week, we start to look at 36 and following, which looks to the future and to the end of the age. More on that when we get there. Before we do that, what should we learn from what we've already looked at? A couple of things seem to be pretty clear to me. Jesus was and will be vindicated. That is, he will be shown to be the Messiah by God himself. This is the real situation, whether the world wants to see it or not. The real situation is that Jesus is the Lord. He is the Messiah. And the fall of Jerusalem is just part of the way, and the empty tomb, all these things are ways in which God shows that the judgment has taken place. And the earthly court judgment has been reversed. God has shown himself to be thoroughly behind who Jesus is and what he's done. Jesus has received the kingdom. That's what Daniel 7:13 says. He has received all power and all authority. He sends out his disciples with this knowledge that he is Lord of Lords and King of Kings. He will be with them to the end of the age. He'll be with us to the end of the age. But this kingdom is a reality. It's not just future. It's already present, and you and I are invited to enter into the reality of this kingdom, to experience life in God's dream, not in its fullness yet, but really to begin to experience God's dream for the world. We're invited to enter it. And then what he says right at the conclusion of that section we've looked at, his words will not pass away. Heaven and earth may pass away, but not my words. His words are trustworthy. So he says to his disciples, go into all the world, make disciples of all the nations, doing what? Teaching them to obey everything that I've commanded you. Because all of his words about the future, about the present, about the past, about the world, about us, they are all true and absolutely reliable. And so he could say in the Sermon on the Mount, a person who builds their life on what I say is like a person who builds their house on a rock. Doesn't matter what kind of assault from wind, rain, weather of any kind, it doesn't matter what assault comes, the house will stand because my words are reliable. The early Christians believed that. We need to believe it today as well. Take it to heart and live in the reality of his kingdom. I'm going to celebrate communion this morning. We'll ask our music people to come up, and Jack is going to lead us today as we remember the Lord who died but came to life and lives today. Let's remember him together.